Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 22nd. I'm your reader, Doug. Today's mini editorial is from the Journal Editorial Board, and they write, "The color-changing light bulbs under the skywalk on 4th Street added a bright, festive touch to Sioux City's annual downtown holiday lighted parade Monday evening." And again, that was from the Journal Editorial Board. Today's 5-day forecast, for today, it's partly sunny with a predicted high of 49 and a low tonight of 20. Wednesday will be also partly sunny with a high of 54 and a low of 28. Thursday is a possible snow shower, breezy and a little bit colder, and with a high of 42 and a low of 23. Friday will be milder with plenty of sunshine with a high of 50 and a low of 27. And also on Saturday, it'll be a high of 56 and a low of 27. There are two pictures on the front page of the paper today from the holiday lighted parade from Monday night. And the first one shows a child leaning over to pick up a piece of candy as a float from Sioux City's International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 231 makes its way down 4th Street during Sioux City's annual downtown holiday lighted parade on Monday. The parade is sponsored by the Electrical Union. And then there is also another picture that shows Santa waving from a horse-drawn wagon to conclude Sioux City's annual downtown holiday lighted parade on Monday. And the parade is sponsored by Sioux City's International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 231. Our first story is from the City Council meeting last night. Council approves development agreement for $24 million multifamily subdivision. The Sioux City Council voted unanimously Monday to approve a development agreement with a local businessman for a $24 million multifamily subdivision on the city's east side. Dan Hiserot of the Ridge SC LLC plans to build a new 212-unit multifamily residential subdivision at the Eagle Ridge Edition, 3800 Glen Ellen Road. Over the last year, city staff has been working with Hiserot. He told the council that the subdivision will consist of 18 buildings, which will be very similar to another one of his projects, 48 South, modern apartments along Southern Hills Drive. "Thank you for doing the development. 212 units is terrific," Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore said. The development property contains roughly 14 acres and is currently vacant. The Planning and Zoning Commission and the City Council both approved the rezoning and final plat in May. The development costs are estimated at $24 million. The estimated value of the completed project is $22 million, according to city documents. The current assessed value of the vacant property is approximately $20,000. Under the terms of the development agreement, Hiserot agrees to apply for and receive all necessary permits, develop the property in accordance with the preliminary site plan so that 212 multifamily residential units can be constructed on the property prior to December 31, 2026, and execute a forgivable promissory note in the amount of $424,000. Moore asked Hiserot if he thinks he can realistically have the project completed by 2026. 48 South was about half this size, and we completed it in about 18 months. So I'd say 3 years is a rough timeline that I think we should be able to get it done, Hiserot said. "Barring any other circumstances, I think by the end of 2026 we should be looking pretty good, although we would definitely come before council and request an extension if we needed to." In May, the council greenlighted resolution supporting the submission of tax credit applications to the Iowa Workforce Housing Tax Credit Program for the Glen Ellen Road project, as well as a multifamily development on the city's north side at 4205 Denise Court. The Denise Court development near Aller Drive will contain 48 market-rate residential units in its first phase. It is anticipated that future phases of the project will contain as many as 10 buildings and 120 units. Candidates for South Sioux Superintendent participate in final interview. South Sioux City Community School District superintendent candidates participated in a final public interview before the district chooses its new leader. The four finalists, Jason Alexander, Derek Ippinson, Ashley O'Dell, and Ronnie Ortega, were interviewed by the school board Monday. Current Superintendent Todd Strum announced recently he would be retiring at the end of the school year after 33 years. The selected superintendent will be announced December 12th. Their first day on the job will be July 1st, 2023. Derek Ippenson has been the North Folk Public High School principal since 2018. He has a doctorate in educational leadership from Doan College, an education specialist degree from the University of Nebraska-Kearney, a master's in education from the University of Nebraska-Kearney, and a bachelor's in education from Doan College. He formerly served as the PK through 12 principal at Shickley Public Schools and an activities director, teacher, and coach at Central Catholic School in West Point. Ippenson said his keys to success define who he is as an administrator. The first key is to define success. The second is to plan and be flexible. The third is to have faith in the people, plans, and preparations. The fourth is to be a leader and champion of people. And the fifth is to work hard and have fun. Ippenson spent November 16th in South Sioux City, meeting people in the district and community. Ippenson said he visited South Sioux three times during the interview process and said each time he left more excited about the community and the district. The passion that people here in South Sioux have for their school and their community is amazing. When asked what he will do to focus on culture, diversity, equity, and inclusion, Ippenson said many conversations need to be had with the different cultural groups of the community. By focusing on culture, diversity, equity, and inclusion, we start to look at them not as something other, but as something just different, and when we embrace our differences, we are stronger, he said. He said he would work with outside organizations to see what they want and need from the district and ensure the district is utilizing already existing partnerships better. Recruitment and retention of school staff is an issue schools across the country are facing. With a variety of different solutions being implemented, such as stipends, higher wages, better benefits, and more. Ippenson was asked what his ideas are related to the issue. He said it starts with building a district staff that trusts one another and that knows their professionalism is relied on for retention. For recruitment, Ippenson said the district needs to be attractive to prospective teachers. District stakeholders and community members said it is important to have a superintendent who is involved in the district. Ippenson was asked how he would get involved. He said he will attend events throughout the district so families can see him and become comfortable speaking with him. He said he'd also be present at community events. Ashley O'Dell has been the assistant superintendent at South Sioux City since last year. She has an education specialist degree and a master's in education school administration from Wayne State College and a bachelor's in education from the University of South Dakota. She formerly served as the South Sioux City High School principal and the assistant principal. Being a lifelong South Sioux City resident, O'Dell said she has the advantage of already having relationships in the community and having been highly involved in community events. She also has a deep knowledge of the district. Though O'Dell works for the district, she still had a day in the district as a candidate and spent time with community members and staff. She said the classrooms, schools, kids, teachers, and principals are the reason she works for the district in the first place. The best things in my life have been a result of the schools, whether it's personal, whether it's professional, she said. When asked what she will do to focus on culture, diversity, equity, and inclusion, O'Dell said diversity is the most unique aspect of the district and is one of the strongest attractors. As a superintendent, she also said she would work with outside organizations to see what needs there are and what the district can do to celebrate the different cultures. O'Dell said the first step in addressing recruitment and retention is making sure the staff feels valued and heard. She said having an open-door policy as a superintendent and hearing the concerns of staff can help people feel more comfortable. Competitive wages are another way to keep staff and recruit more, she said. District stakeholders and community members said it's important to have a superintendent be involved in the district. O'Dell was asked how she will be involved. O'Dell said she attends various activities throughout the district and believes it is important that the community knows the superintendent is connected to the community. This is home for us. This is where we want to be. This is where we want to raise our kids, she said. I feel connected to the community and my family do too, and we have a really good one to be proud of. Jason Alexander has been the superintendent of Beatrice Public Schools since 2018. He has an education specialist degree and a master's in education from the University of Nebraska-Kearney and a bachelor's in education from Chadron State College. He formerly served as superintendent and principal at Ord Public Schools and a principal at Burwell Elementary School. Alexander spent November 15th in South Sioux City meeting people in the district and community. Alexander said South Sioux City is a great district with great people, and it is evident that there is community pride in the school district. When asked what he will do to focus on culture, diversity, equity, and inclusion, Alexander said they need to first have conversations on what the district is doing well. He said the district then needs to reach out to people, listen to their needs, and then address them. We have to listen. That's probably the key factor, he said. If we want to get people's input, we have to be willing to listen to what they say. And sometimes we have to be honest with ourselves and say, do we need to do this differently? Alexander said being competitive is the best way to recruit and retain teachers. He said the world of education is changing and the district has to be ahead of the competitors. He said the district needs to find the selling points of South Sioux City to show people a reason to move there. For retention, Alexander said the district has to include staff in the decision-making processes and have conversations with staff on what will keep them in the district. District stakeholders and community members said it is important to have a superintendent that is involved in the district, and Alexander was asked how he will be involved. Alexander said involvement is an important aspect of being a superintendent. They want to know that you're approachable. They want to know you're personable and that they can talk to you, he said. He said attending school activities and being involved in community organizations such as the Chamber of Commerce and Kiwanis are ways to be out in the community. Ronnie Otega has been the Bryan High School principal in Omaha for 4 years. He has a doctorate in educational leadership, a master's in education leadership, and a master's in school counseling from the University of Nebraska-Omaha, and a bachelor's in secondary education from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He formerly served as the executive director of school support and supervision for the Omaha Public School District and the principal of Buffett Magnet Middle School in Omaha. Otega said there are 244 districts in Nebraska, and only three that he would consider working at. South Sioux City is one of them. I feel that my strengths perfectly align to your challenges here. You have everything in place, and it is just needing some strong leadership and the right kind of leadership to really move things forward, he said. Ortega spent November 16th in South Sioux City, meeting people throughout the district and community. He said it was a rigorous day, and he said it was worth his time. I got a lot of information, not only the strengths, but the challenges, he said. I continue to feel that I can address some of those challenges, that some of the challenges you are facing now are challenges I have previously addressed. When asked what he'll do to focus on culture, diversity, equity, and inclusion, Ortega said it was a lens that he looks at things and a lens he was born with. He said it's important for the kids to see themselves in the school district and in the school staff. He said he loves the community, is proud of, and values diversity. I would like to push the community a little bit more to move to that next step of inclusion and equity, he said. Those are some of the challenges in South Sioux City Community Schools, is how do we take that step from valuing and appreciating diversity to ensuring equitable outcomes for our kids. Ortega said Bryan High School in Omaha is known as the inclusive school in the district and the only school where the students in advanced academics mirror the school demographics. When asked about how he will address recruitment and retention, Ortega said he would want to look at ways to provide education to the classified staff and help them advance to teachers and administrators for the district. When it comes to recruitment, Ortega said taking in student teachers is a great way to recruit teachers and see if they will be a good fit with the district. District stakeholders and community members said it is important to have a superintendent that is involved in the district, and Ortega was asked how he would be involved. Ortega said currently working at a large high school, there is an event or activity every night that he could attend. He said he tries to balance his time in the community with his leadership team to have a presence at the events. You want to be at all events, but it is not humanly possible. So how do you work with your leadership team to ensure that there is district representation at all events that are important to the community, he said. He said he looks forward to identifying opportunities in South Sioux City where he can be of value and have a presence. The Board of Education hired Hazard Young, Atia and Associates to help with the national search for the next superintendent. The district distributed a survey as well as had focus groups throughout the community to determine what traits was wanted in the next superintendent. And you can go to YouTube to watch the full interviews. Judge denies new trial request in Lake Park murder case, Spirit Lake. A judge has denied a new trial for a Sioux City woman found guilty of strangling a woman to death inside her Lake Park, Iowa home. District Judge Shane Mayer issued the ruling Friday, overruling two defense motions for a new trial for Allison Decker, whom Mayer found guilty in June of first-degree murder, third-degree theft, and conspiracy to commit third-degree theft for the December 21, 2020 death of 25-year-old Angel Bassman. Decker, 27, had waived her right to a jury trial, and Mayer heard the case during a five-day trial in May in Dickinson County District Court. After the trial, defense attorney Edward Bjornstad filed the motions for a new trial because of insufficient evidence in the trial, and also because, he said, new evidence had been discovered. Evidence and testimony at trial revealed that Justice Bernstein and Bassman had been using the belt to administer heroin, and they began arguing. The argument then turned into a physical altercation between Decker and Bassman. Bernstein testified he handed the belt to Decker and left the room as Decker was strangling Bassman with it. Statements and social media messages Decker sent to friends also linked her to the murder. Decker and Bernstein then stole the electronics and other household and personal items from the house. Hearings on Bjornstad's motions were conducted in August and October, and Mayer, in a written ruling, said the defense had failed to put forth any admissible evidence that had not previously been considered, and there is substantial evidence against Decker. Nothing in defendants' motions or offers of proof has changed the court's view of this case, Mayer said in her ruling. Decker faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. A sentencing date has yet to be set. 4 days after Bassman's body was found, police spotted Bernstein driving Bassman's missing rental car in Sioux City. A vehicle pursuit ensued, and Bernstein, who gave an Elk Point, South Dakota address at the time, was arrested after crashing the car. Bernstein and Decker both later were found in possession of property belonging to Bassman and her family. Bernstein, 25, also was charged with first-degree murder, but pleaded guilty to attempted murder in exchange for agreeing to testify against Decker. He was sentenced in June to 25 years in prison and must serve 17.5 years before he's eligible for parole. Sioux City recognizes 20th Annual Memorial March to Honor Lost Children. Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott recognized the 20th Annual Memorial March to Honor Lost Children by reading a special proclamation during Monday's City Council meeting. The proclamation not only recognized the march, but also November 2022 as Native American Month. We support the commitment of the Native community to their continued efforts and focus on building bridges and fostering understanding, Scott read. We thank the Community Initiative for Native Children and Families and all the individuals and organizations responsible for holding the Memorial March to Honor Lost Children. We wish them much success. Each year, in the days before Thanksgiving, hundreds gather in downtown Sioux City for the march, which remembers Native American children who have been taken from their families and communities to be placed in the country's non-Native child welfare system. This year's march begins at 7:30 a.m. Wednesday at War Eagle Monument and ends at the Sioux City Convention Center with a traditional memorial dinner. Initially, this started off as a protest because we were not getting answers, and the frustration and things that come from that. We feel better that there's accountability, Manape Lemire, a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska and Native American activist, said while accepting the proclamation from Scott. But I also have to just be mindful that my father said there's always more work to be done. We see that, and the allies in this community see that, and we are blessed to have those bridges built right now. Since the death of his father, Native American activist Frank Lemire, in 2019, Lemire has helped encourage the Native American community to better organize. We are working tirelessly to try to develop things that will be of service on the front end, as opposed to on the back end, Lemire said. We believe that we quantify that to, for every dollar spent on the front end, it'll save $13 on the back end. And then we are in discussions of economic development for ourselves so we can be self-sustaining and have a positive impact on the Sioux City community. Early woman gets probation for death of pig, Sac City. An early Iowa woman charged in connection with the deaths of more than 1,000 pigs in hog confinement facilities was placed on probation Monday. Elena Labor, 34, pleaded to one count of first-degree criminal mischief in September in Sac County District Court. District Judge Derek Johnson suspended a 10-year prison sentence and placed Labor on probation for 3 years. She will be required to pay restitution in an amount to be determined. Additional charges of first-degree criminal mischief and animal neglect were dismissed as part of the plea agreement. Law enforcement officers discovered the pigs in varying stages of decomposition in two confinement sites in late June after receiving a report. The pigs had had no access to feed or water. According to the Sac County Sheriff's Office, labor, whose job was to maintain both sites, told deputies someone had shut off the breakers that controlled the electricity the night before, causing the pig's death. A veterinary inspection determined the pigs had been dead for at least a week. Labor later told deputies she knew the pigs had been dead but did not know what to do. The pigs were owned by Corey AGR Inc. of Lytton, Iowa. The estimated loss is more than $150,000. Hard Rock announces its support of Hubbard Park. Hard Rock Hotel and Casino Sioux City announced they will be supporting Hubbard Park by contributing the softball field scoreboard. Alongside Sioux City local and Iowa Fast Pitch Hall of Famer Pete Sandman, longtime park caretaker Steve Hauge and umpire Delbert Christensen, Hard Rock is among the community organizers banding together to breathe life into Hubbard Park, which was first constructed in the 1930s. Hard Rock is excited to be part of this historic restoration, Hard Rock Hotel and Casino City, Sioux City Assistant Manager Mike Adams said in a statement. Siouxland man sought on terroristic threat charges. The U.S. Marshals Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the following person: Miguel Benson, 22. He is 5 feet 11 inches tall and weighs 200 pounds. Benson is wanted on a warrant issued in Dakota County for failure to appear on charges of terrorism, threats, and a weapon violation. Anyone with information can call 712-252-0211 or siouxlands.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. Norfolk man killed in crash. A Norfolk, Nebraska man died as a result of a single vehicle accident which occurred southwest of Battle Creek, Nebraska. Shortly after 8 a.m. Monday, Norfolk dispatch was notified of a vehicle in the ditch east of 545th Avenue on 834th Road. Madison County Sheriff's deputies responded and located a 2002 Nissan Xterra in a creek bed on the south side of the road with heavy damage. Deputies determined that sometime Sunday night the vehicle left the roadway, struck a bridge before becoming airborne. It then struck the opposite side of the creek bed before coming to rest in the creek bed. Albert A. Reeves, 67, the driver and sole component of the crash, was killed during the crash. Alcohol was not believed to be a contributing factor. Seatbelts were not in use at the time of the crash. Iowa turkeys to be pardoned virtually due to bird flu. An annual tradition is heading online as a state and agriculture officials exercise caution with the threat of bird flu looming. Governor Kim Reynolds will pardon two turkeys via video Tuesday morning, the governor's office said Monday. The annual tradition typically is conducted at the governor's mansion on Terrace Hill in Des Moines, but an avian influenza, commonly known as bird flu, has been infecting flocks throughout the Midwest, including Iowa, since March. With that specter looming, officials determined it was unsafe to transport turkeys this week. Instead, Reynolds will record a video message that will be published Tuesday morning on the governor's social media accounts. Iowa's turkey pardoning event is something the governor looks forward to every year, but with a statewide order currently in place to protect flocks from the threat of highly pathogenic avian influenza, the turkeys will not be transported to Terrace Hill, Reynolds spokesman Alex Murphy said via email. The State Agriculture Department on November 10th, for the second time this year, issued an order canceling all live bird exhibitions and other gatherings of birds. The previous order was issued March 23rd and lifted June 3rd. The most recent confirmation of a new case of bird flu came October 31st in a commercial flock in Wright County. It was the 21st confirmed case this year. The 2022 bird flu has not been nearly as destructive as 2015, when more than 31 million birds died or were euthanized, causing $1.2 billion in economic damage, according to one report. Reynolds also Tuesday will participate in the annual tree lighting ceremony at the Iowa Capitol. Reynolds is not expected to field questions at the tree lighting event, her spokesman said. Reynolds has not held a formal gathering with State House reporters since July. Earlier this month, she was elected to another four-year term. We will now move to the sports section. Our first story, Dort wins first NAIA title in men's cross country. Sioux Center. The Dort University men's cross-country team has claimed the school's first NAIA team title. The defenders posted a team score of 97 points to beat out national runner-up Milligan, Tennessee, who finished with 115 points at Apalachee Regional Park in Tallahassee, Florida last weekend. Dort head coach Nate Wolf was named the NAIA Men's Cross Country Coach of the Year following the race. Dort was in sixth place at the 1200 millimeter mark and closed ground to second with 2200 millimeters gone by. The defenders moved into the lead at the 4000 millimeter mark when they overtook the Masters and then held on to first place for the entirety of the second half of the race to win the title. Peter Shippey made a crucial move to the front pack after 5,000 millimeters to strengthen, well, I don't think that's millimeters, 5,000 m, it said, to strengthen Dort's lead until top-ranked, and a defending champion Milligan made a charge over the last 1,500. Milligan closed to within 18 points with 1,000 remaining, but Dort pushed through and maintained its 18-point margin. Final margin of victory. It was the first team men's cross-country championship won by a GPAC school. Joe Anderson, one of four defender runners to earn All-American honors, was the top Dort finisher for the fifth time this season. Earning All-American honors for the first time, he bettered his previous best finish at Nationals by 44 spots. Davis Tebben was the second Dort runner to cross the finish line, doing so in 17th place and establishing a personal best time of 24:35, 3 seconds faster than his previous run at the Defenders' home meet this season. Tebben's previous best finish at Nationals was 49th, and like Anderson, is a first-time NAIA All-American. Shippey, who made the big move late in the race to help the Defenders win the title, held on to 18th place finish with a personal best time of 24:36. Also a first-time NAIA All-American in cross country, Shippey was 18 seconds faster than his previous career best run earlier this year at Dort's home meet. The senior made up 68 spots throughout the race. Eric Steiger finished the race in 23rd place and earns All-American honors for the second consecutive season. Ethan Summerhays was the fifth Dort runner and the final counter toward the team score. Summerhays placed 45th overall, his best finish at the national championship with a time of 25. Competing in his first national championship race, Aiden Voister ran a personal best time of 25:02 and finished 50th overall. Trey Engen completed the defenders lineup with his best finish at the national meet, placing 148th with a time of 25:54. With Anderson, Tebben, Shippey, and Steiger all being named NAIA All-American, the number of defender men's cross-country runners to claim the national honor is now at 8. South Dakota volleyball team earns number one seed for Summit League tournament. Vermilion. The University of South Dakota heads into the Summit League volleyball tournament this week as the number one seed. As the top seed, the Coyotes earned a first round bye and will play their first match of the tournament at 4 p.m. Friday in Omaha. USD will face the winner of the number 4 Denver versus number 5 South Dakota State match. USD 27-3 won the regular season conference title with a 16-2 record. The top six teams advanced to the postseason tournament Thursday through Saturday at Baxter Arena in Omaha. The winner receives the league's automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. The Coyotes swept North Dakota 3-0 Saturday in their last home match of the regular season. Game scores were 25-12, 25-22, 25-19. USD received a match-high 15 kills from junior Elizabeth Junkie, as she became the Summit League single-season kills record holder with 634 kills this season. South Dakota Senior Day win saw a healthy offensive effort for the Coyotes, featuring four hitters with 7 kills apiece behind Yankees' match-high number. Senior Amy Adams clocked her 7 kills with no errors to hit 500 on the match. Three back row defenders saw double-digit digs this afternoon, including a match-high 13 digs from senior Lolo Weidman. Elena Wolf tallied 10 digs, while Yankee had 12 digs to record her 22nd double-double on the season. Harm's 7 kills were accompanied by 5 blocks, including 1 solo block. Maddie Wooden dished out 32 assists. "I really feel like Amy and Lolo stepped up a lot this year," head coach Leanne Williamson said. "They were not only really good at holding their teammates accountable, but they were really good at trying to get the best out of everybody around them." I'm really excited for them to sit back and celebrate with their families and with the team, but their careers are not over yet. They have done remarkable things as a group up to this point, and we are excited for this week. You were listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Normally we would do obituaries, but there are none in today's paper, so we will continue with sports. Morningside women stop three-game skid, cruise over Benedictine 74-57. The Morningside women's basketball team broke a three-game losing streak Saturday with a 74-57 win over Benedictine. Morningside put up 24 points in the third quarter, cruising to the victory over the Ravens, who received votes in the NAIA preseason women's basketball coaches poll. The Mustangs fell behind going into the half as Benedictine hit a three to go into the break, but came on strong in the final two quarters, outscoring the Ravens 41-23 in the second half. Chloe Lofstrom was key for the Mustangs, putting up 24 points and pulling down 14 boards, with 12 rebounds coming on defense. Her effort marks the first double-double for the team this season. Morningside has three other players in double figures, with Sophia Peppers and Aspen Jansa each netting 13 points and McKenna Sims scoring 11. Peppers also pulled down 8 boards in the game. The Mustangs, who had dropped the three previous games to Sterling, Dakota Wesleyan, and Dort, improves to 2-3 on the season. Morningside, 0-2 in the GPAC, travels to Doane University Tuesday for a conference game that tips off at 6 p.m. in Crete, Nebraska. Morningside men's basketball knock off two NAIA-ranked teams. The Morningside University men's basketball team ran its season record to 6-0 after knocking off two ranked teams in the inaugural Small College Basketball Champions Classic this weekend in Aberdeen, South Dakota. The Mustangs cruised past number 14 ranked Indiana Wesleyan University 85-61 Saturday, a day after defeating number 16 Carroll, Montana 72-54. Morningside's Eli Doble was named the SCB Champions Classic MVP, and Joyce Scoff and Jack Dotsler were named to the tournament team. In Saturday's game at Northern State's Rocks Arena, Morningside took the lead after just over 5 minutes of play in the first half, as Doble got an offensive rebound and put the ball back up for 2 points, taking a 15-14 lead. The Mustangs would not look back as Brendan Buckley made the next bucket, followed by Doble again. Scoff and Dotsler would make it 24-14 before IWU would score again. The lead would get cut to 5 points, but Morningside remained on top, opening up to as much as a 28-point lead with under 6 minutes to play in the contest. Doble led the way on offense for the Mustangs with 24 points. Dotsler recorded 21 and Scoff 18. Dobler and Dotsler would also lead in the rebounds column with 9 and 6 respectively. In Friday's win against Carroll, Mustangs jumped out to a first half advantage. Trey Powers was perfect from the floor in the first half, going 5 for 5 overall and 2 for 2 from beyond the 3-point arc for the 12 first half points. The Mustangs held a 13-point lead at the half. Carroll rallied early in the second half, cutting the lead to 4 with 7:10 to play. The Mustangs' defense locked down the final 7 minutes of the game, allowing 2 made baskets as Morningside pulled away. Scoff and Doble had big second-half performances to finish with 19 points each. Doble and Powers led the team with 7 rebounds apiece. Dotsler added 8 points. Morningside is at Doane University on Tuesday with a 7:45 p.m. tip from Crete, Nebraska. Briarcliff women's soccer loses in regional tournament. In a snowy NAIA national tournament contest in Michigan, the Briarcliff women's soccer team fell in the opening round 3-1 to Cumberland of Tennessee last Thursday. "We had some good moments, but it was not enough to get us through," said head coach Clark Charleston. "It was a solid fall. Our aspirations will remain high for the future. We will do a deep analysis on areas that we need to improve, and we will get to work." Cumberland's Haley Stevens scored the first goal of the game in the opening minute of the play off Evelyn Jimenez's assist. The Phoenix held a 1-0 lead until the 32nd minute when Tia Lizzie sent across that found Taylor Alcree, who scored the header to tie the game at 1-1. The Chargers took 3 shots in the opening half, while the Phoenix had 11 shots. Ruby Campa was key in the first half, making 4 saves to keep Cumberland to the 1 goal. After a Cumberland goal in the 54th minute, the Chargers had a prime scoring opportunity 2 minutes later. Briarcliff sent a corner kick that found Lissy, who shot ricochet off the crossbar, the side post, and ended up in the keeper's hand. The Phoenix added an insurance goal in the 72nd minute to take a 3-1 advantage. The Chargers took 10 shots with 6 on goal, compared to 20 and 9 on goal for Cumberland. BC was awarded 7 corner kicks to the Phoenix's 4. Hannah Shuttleworth took 3 shots to lead BC. Lissy, Mady Sommer, and Alcar all took 2 shots apiece. Sommer and Alcar each put 2 shots on net. Campa made 6 saves in her 90 minutes in net. Briarcliff ends the season with a 13-3-4 overall record and a 10-0-2 in the GPAC. We'll now move to a food story. Think autumnal colors when preparing your Thanksgiving Day meal. When it comes to Thanksgiving feasts, Iowa State University Extension and Outreach Human Services Specialist Renee Swears is in favor of going green, as well as red, orange, and yellow for that matter. Autumn has such beautiful colors, Swears said. Your Thanksgiving meal should be visually appealing and delicious. An easy way to add color is with the stuffing incorporating chopped apples and ruby red cranberries. Or create a kaleidoscope of colors with a coleslaw made from green and purple cabbage. Add slivers of carrots and celery before tossing in extra crunch with sliced apples. Pumpkins, squash, and any type of gourd can be roasted for a delectable side dish. So can a sweet potato. A roasted sweet potato is always nice, Weirs suggested. It can be topped with something sweet or savory. Not only that, but a sweet potato is a great source of fiber, vitamins, and minerals. They are also rich in antioxidants that can protect your body from chronic diseases. However, the star of the show on Turkey Day is, of course, the turkey. Swears recommends buying a fresh turkey only a day or two before Thanksgiving. Be sure to keep it in the refrigerator until you're ready to cook it. Place it on a tray or a pan to catch any juices that may leak. But never buy fresh, pre-stuffed turkeys. If not handled with care, any harmful bacteria that may be in the stuffing can multiply quickly, Swears explained. Be sure to keep your frozen turkeys frozen until you're ready to thaw it. A turkey can be thawed safely in a refrigerator. Just be sure to keep the turkey in its original wrapper while placing it on a tray to catch any leakage. But remember, thawing a 20 to 24 pound turkey in a fridge can take up to 5 or 6 days. Thawing a turkey in cold water is a faster process. A 20 to 24 pound bird can be thawed in 10 to 12 hours. Submerge your wrapped turkey in cold tap water, changing the water every 30 minutes, Swears said. Cook the bird immediately after it is thawed. Here are a few numbers to memorize. When it comes to roasting a turkey, set your oven no lower than 325 degrees. Also, use a food thermometer to ensure your turkey and stuffing with a safe minimal internal temperature of 165. Discard any turkey, stuffing, or gravy left out at room temperature longer than 2 hours. Use refrigerated turkey within 3 to 4 days. However, frozen leftovers can be used for 3 to 6 months for best quality. Thanksgiving is a holiday that revolves around food, Swears said. You must always be mindful when it comes to food safety practices. Another thing to be mindful of, how much you eat. That's a problem many people experience, Swears explained. We mindlessly eat what's in front of us. Instead, we need to be mindful eaters. You don't need to fill your plate to capacity, she added. Take only the amount that you want. You can always get more if you're still hungry. Never forget that Thanksgiving is also about spending time with family and friends. There is something really special about cooking a holiday meal, Swears said. It is often about the company as much as the food. Yet, don't forget to show off festive fall colors when it comes to your feast. I love Thanksgiving, Swears said. Make it as colorful as you can. California drought hurts Iowa beekeepers. Mount Vernon, Iowa. Some Iowa beekeepers make extra money by taking their bees to California for the winter to pollinate almond trees, but that work is literally drying up with a drought on the West Coast. Some of the old orchards are being torn out, said Phil Ebert, 80, founder of Abert Honey, with operations in Mount Vernon and Linville. We've lost our spot out there, and I don't know if we're going to be able to find another one. California, which produces 80% of the world's almonds, has long relied on honeybees for pollination because most almond trees varieties do not self-pollinate, said Josette Lewis, chief scientific officer with the Almond Board of California. California beekeepers provide about one-third of the bees for almond pollination, but because almonds have exploded in popularity in the last 25 years, and because the pollination window is only about a month, California almond growers must recruit beekeepers from other states. A larger portion comes from the western part of the United States, but honeybees come from all over the country, Lewis said. That has increasingly been an attractive feature for beekeepers. Not only do almond growers pay about $200 per colony of bees for the season, bees that help with almond pollination get a feast of pollen and nectar much earlier in the season than bees overwintering in Iowa. The real benefit is when the bees come home, the boxes are full, Ebert said. This means he can split the hive to form more colonies and increase honey production. But 3 years into a drought, California's 2022 almond harvest was estimated to be 11% below last year, with a projected yield of 1,900 pounds per acre, the lowest since 2009, according to a U.S. Department of Agriculture report released in July. Almond producers are in the painful position where we have both limited water resources and, if you do get water, you'll be paying a higher price, as well as higher input costs, Lewis said. All of this happened at a time when almond prices have been really low, predominantly due to supply chain problems. California's Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which went into effect in 2021, prohibits farmers and others from pumping too much water from underground aquifers. This law and other market forces have caused some California almond growers to remove trees, Lewis said. We did see a small uptick in the amount of almond orchards removed, probably as a result of the drought, she said. There are certain areas of the state that will face long-term restrictions on water. Going forward, that remains something we'll keep a watch on as we go into another year of strained profitability. Fewer acres of almonds mean less of a need for honeybee pollinators. The Ebers have transported honeybees to California from Iowa the last 4 years, trucking hundreds of colonies to almond groves in November or December so the bees are ready for almond pollination in February and March. If they can't get a spot in California, the Ebers might take their bees to Texas. They wouldn't get paid there, but the bees would start getting pollen in January versus March or April in Iowa. In either state, the Eberts would have to go out in January and early February to feed the bees and maintain the hives. I'm still trying to get them to California, said Adam Ebert, one of Phil's sons. The almond pollination pays really well. The USDA announced this week it will resume a survey of farmers to see who is using honeybee pollinators and how much it costs. Data from the survey, discontinued in 2018 because of USDA budget constraints, helps producers develop their budgets and provide documentation for crop insurance, Lewis said. The USDA's National Agriculture Statistics Service has mailed questionnaires to about 16,000 producers and will start collecting data immediately, the agency said. The report to be published in January will include data from the 2017 and the 2022 surveys, including paid pollinator acres, price per acre, colonies used, price per colony, and total value of pollination per crop. We now have an entertainment story entitled A Swinging Christmas. Cirque Musica combines music, acrobats for all new holiday show. Stephen Cook always wanted to combine the showmanship of a Broadway musical with the excitement of a circus. With Cirque Musica, the veteran touring company producer was able to get the best of both worlds. We were able to attract top musicians and top aerialists from around the world for one exciting show, Cook explained. I'm positive audiences have not seen anything like it. The all-new Cirque Musica Holiday Wonderland, coming to the Orpheum Theater, 528 Pier Street for 7:30 p.m. November 25th show, stars Samantha Duval as Caroline, who travels between two worlds to save the holiday spirit. According to Cook, Holiday Wonderland is a musical journey that can transport audiences to a magical faraway land for a fun-filled holiday experience. More than that, the show boasts one of Cirque Musica's largest international casts. We have circus performers from Australia, Brazil, Mexico, Mongolia, and even Ukraine, Cook said. Luckily, the Ukrainian performers have worked for us for years and are not directly impacted by that country's current war. Indeed, Cirque Musica has employed many of the world's most mesmerizing acrobats and daredevils since its inception in 2010. With multiple productions of such Cirque Musica shows as Rhapsody, Crescendo, Heroes and Villains, Symphonic, as well as Holiday Wonderland going on across the continent, Cook said he's hit upon a formula that will resonate and captivate all members of the family. I think parents will enjoy the beautiful sets and the holiday music performed by a live band, and the kids will be thrilled by all of our aerialists, he explained. However, staging such a show does not come without peril. Holiday Wonderland will be presented at 35 major North American cities over a two-month period, Cook said. Each stop is literally like having a circus come to town. We have multiple touring vehicles and a support team that is expert at putting up and tearing down all of the equipment a circus would need, he continued. On top of that, music is of equal importance to any Cirque Musica performance. It truly is a big undertaking. Yet, is it all worthwhile after an extended COVID-19 related hiatus? Like all touring companies, we had to cancel all performance during the pandemic, Cook said. We went well over a year with no performances. Since the start of 2022, Cirque Musica is back to its regular schedule, and Cook is happy to report that audiences have returned. I guess it's understandable, he said. As anxious as our cast members were to perform again, audience was just as excited to see live entertainment again. After all, Cirque Musica presents theater in a very unique way. Holiday Wonderland, in particular, hits all of the buttons as a show with something for everyone, Cook said. The sets, costumes, and lighting are as beautiful as the music. Plus, the acrobats will draw oohs and ahs from the audiences of all ages. Spectators will be dazzled by both the acrobats as well as the holiday cheer, Cook explained. Our Holiday Wonderland blends the spellbinding grace and daredevil athleticism of the world's greatest circus performers with a musical mix of timeless seasonal favorites performed live, which is exactly what Cook wanted when combining the majesty of music with the thrill-a-minute appeal of the circus. It's rare that the entire family can share an unforgettable experience at the same time. We want you to create holiday memories that will last forever at Holiday Wonderland. We'll now move back to the sports section for the Nebraska-Iowa game. A November to remember or forget, Nebraska and Iowa are opposites again. Kirk Ferentz is just warming up. Literally, as the Iowa coach began shaking off Arctic level temperatures late Saturday afternoon underneath Minnesota's Huntington Bank Stadium. But perhaps more satisfyingly, with a 15-minute chat with the local media discussing a four-week Hawkeyes transformation from beleaguered to beguiled, Ferentz and multiple players reflected on a gutsy 13-10 win over the Gophers, sparked by consecutive takeaways by linebacker Jack Campbell in the final 6 minutes via a forced fumble and interception return. The coach took a victory lap on his decision to stick with Spencer Petras as starting quarterback. Players reveled in the collective resilience it took to hang tough both Saturday and all season after a 54-10 blowout loss at Ohio State last month left Iowa 3-4. You're always hoping to play for something in November, but you never know what it's going to be, Ferentz said. I don't know anything about gambling, but I guess if you put 10 bucks on us 4 weeks ago, you'd probably be okay. Now, the Hawkeyes are a game away from their second straight Big Ten West title and a shot at the Michigan-Ohio State winner in the league championship in Indianapolis. All that stands in the way is Nebraska. Ferentz said he hadn't spoken a word to his team about the stakes, but our guys know what's going on. Win and Iowa is in, lose and Purdue with a win against Indiana, or Illinois with a win over Northwestern, will pass the Hawkeyes by. The things we preach ring true week to week, Petras said. Continue to improve. Four straight wins is never easy, especially in the Big Ten in November. Just really proud of our guys. Gotta keep it going. Iowa and Nebraska, in the 11th month of the year, have been as similar as turkeys and cereal. The Hawkeyes are winners of 14 straight November games dating back to 2019. NU is 2-12 in the same span, while dropping the last eight such contests. While lack of depth and a line of scrimmage have buried Nebraska, a stubborn adherence to a longtime identity, timely defense, conservative offense, reliable special teams, has Iowa soaring. I just think it's a testament to our program, our program's culture, and our head coach, Petra said, all of the above. The Iowa quarterback in his last four outings has completed 63 of 100 passes for 727 yards, three touchdowns, and no interceptions to quiet October outcries for his benching. Iowa did not commit a penalty Saturday, and while Minnesota ran for a whopping 312 yards, the most the Hawkeyes have allowed in 6 years, IU had held the previous four schools to fewer than 90 apiece. Nebraska has not beaten its eastern neighbor since the last time Bo Pelini walked the Husker sidelines in a 37-34 overtime win that required a 17-point comeback in 2014. Since then have come a parade of indignities, including four straight one-possession losses featuring two last-second field goals and two failed last-chance drives. Nebraska players saw their losing streak to Wisconsin extend to 9 games Saturday in a similar come-from-ahead defeat that was equal parts unlikely and altogether predictable. There's only one draw to address now, the emotional Husker said afterwards. We obviously have a chip on our shoulder with those guys, NU edge rusher Garrett Nelson said. So staying together for one last week and cherishing these months with the seniors and playing as hard as we can for one last game against Iowa. While the Huskers are about to turn the page on their season to a new coach, player decisions on their individual futures, and another quiet bowl season, Iowa is just warming up again. We've got one more, Petra said. Gotta go finish it out because we've got a hell of a lot to play for. We'll now move to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I am in a relationship I can't get out of. I was told by my boyfriend, and that's in quotes, that what he's doing is normal. He says it's what people who love each other do, and he loves me more than anyone has ever loved me. I have told him repeatedly that I don't love him. He drives by my house and follows me to work. He has also watched to make sure I'm going where I said, like to the gym and the store. He tells me that every man wants to have sex with me and that I dress too sexy. I mostly wear leggings and tank tops. He has monitored Zoom meetings that I go to. All of the watching and following is without my permission or knowledge. He usually tells me about it later, saying he only does it out of love. This has been going on for a few years. Why do I put up with it? I have tried to break up. It started after a few months together. But he guilted me into staying, saying he'd be all alone or he'd kill himself. Then I found out he filmed us having sex a few times, and he's threatening that if I don't stay, people will see it. Please tell me what to do. I have no self-esteem left, and yes, I feel like the slut that I am made out to be. I'm not sure what you can do to help me. I have no one to talk to. Signed, Anonymous Prisoner. Abby responds, this person does not love you. Your boyfriend is an abuser, a stalker, an extortionist. You are right that you need someone to talk to. Actually, I can think of more than one. Pick up the phone and call 800-799-7233. It is a toll-free number for the National Domestic Violence Hotline. A counselor there will be happy to offer suggestions on how to deal with your abuser. During the conversation, ask whether his threat to make the sex tape public should be reported to the police. I think it should be. And P.S., please stop feeling guilty. If you are worried that he might kill himself if you end the relationship, don't be. He has no intention of following through. Dear Abby, our son died suddenly a month ago. It was a terrible shock. The same day, his mother, my wife, announced, we are done as a couple. We have been married 41 years, but our relationship has always been rocky. She hasn't spoken to me since then. I have two areas of deep grief and no one to talk with to share the agony of losing a son and a marriage simultaneously. Family members and close friends have been sympathetic, but most don't know what to say. Any advice would be welcome. Signed, Mourning in Tennessee. Abby responds, please accept my deepest sympathy for the death of your son. Because you have no one to confide in, it's important you start talking with a grief counselor about the double loss you have experienced. It will take time to work through the sadness you are feeling in the aftermath of your son's passing. While no one can blame you for your anger at your wife or her poor timing, once your sadness lessens, you may realize how fortunate you are to finally be freed from a 41-year unhappy marriage. And that concludes today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, November 22nd. I'm Dagna, your reader today. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you so much for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.